Hello and welcome back to the Earfuel podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can follow me on Twitter at @GetEarfuel and at The Daily Guru. The podcast is always available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Earfuel and at GetEarfuel.com. This week, I am going to delve into the history and cultural importance of one of the most storied venues in all of music. It's going to be a lot of fun. But before that, a very quick album review. The album I want to look at today is the third studio release from Thundercat, and it's simply called Drunk. Now, you may know Thundercat from his work with Flying Lotus or a ton of other musicians, but his stuff as a solo artist has been some of my favorite, most notably his 2011 debut. Blending together jazz, funk, hip-hop, and crazy futuristic sounds, Thundercat weaves these smooth, cool tunes like nothing else around. The very idea of musical experimentation seems to be his forte, and yet it's always very appealing and listenable. That is to say, he innovates sounds, but has a very good ear for what's good and what's not. Drunk begins in a very promising way, with his signature funky space grooves in place instantly, and you're quickly catapulted into this chilled-out hyperspace. Granted, the lyrics on Captain Stupido are a bit... I don't know if childish is the right word, but maybe just a bit below expectations, and sadly, this becomes a trend across the entire 51-minute runtime. While there's no denying that Thundercat can create some of the most wonderfully hypnotic soundscapes on Earth, there just isn't enough diversity within them this time to keep the tracks from sort of blending together. The mood rarely moves, and while that's usually a good thing, it just becomes draining, which is a massive disappointment to me. Basically, the entire middle section of the record is a group of songs indistinguishable from one another. Even when Kendrick Lamar shows up on the song Walk On By, it doesn't mix things up enough to perk up your ears. The record just drags. I mean, you can only throw a slow-knocking space beat so many times before, well, before we get the point and we need something a bit more than that. I will say that I love the track Lava Lamp, as I think it's the best example of what Thundercat is trying to do on nearly every track here. The pieces work properly, and it's definitely worth checking out, along with the instrumental called Uh-Uh. It is insane, it's brilliant, it's that simple, you have to give your ears that one. But aside from those two moments, I was really let down by this record. There's wasted potential all around, so skip this one. But if you don't know Thundercat, go and check out his Golden Age of Apocalypse album. Enjoy. Moving on. Music doesn't just sort of happen. That is to say, you eventually need an audience and some sort of place you can expose others to your sounds. In most cases, especially in modern times, you need to find kind of the club or bar in your town that caters to your specific sound or style. That's just the consequence of a homogeneous music culture, and it kind of sucks. But just a few decades ago, there were a handful of venues that didn't play by such rules. They were edgy, counterculture gathering places, and in many ways, they were actually beyond counterculture. These days, such venues are held in massively high reverence, and yet most people don't know the details of how they came to be and just why they're so damn important. And today, I want to discuss the very unlikely circumstances that made a sequence of four letters take on a meaning known throughout the music world, CBGB. So, a note at the top, CBGB is a singular word, and that is the name of the venue. The name of the venue is CBGB. I hear people say CBGBs all the time. Again, the club name was CBGB. You don't see gigs advertised at the Whiskey A Go-Go's, right? Okay, I will stop being grammar guy. Now let's go all the way back to 1973. Actually, you know what? We're going to go back a few years earlier than that, but perhaps before that, a quick explanation of geography is in order, because for those of you unfamiliar with New York City neighborhoods, there are some basic geographical things here that I think are necessary. All of the neighborhoods, well, okay, most of the neighborhoods we're going to discuss today are located in Lower Manhattan. And by Lower Manhattan, we're talking everything below 14th Street. If you don't know, Manhattan is basically a grid, so the numbers go up every street as you go north. So everything below 14th Street, it's an east-west street, and it runs across the entire island that is Manhattan. And you know what? I think I actually need to get a little bit more specific. We are going to be discussing the group of neighborhoods that are basically bordered by 14th Street to the north, Houston Street, which a lot of people will read as Houston Street, to the south, Broadway to the west, and the East River to the east, obviously. Okay, that makes more sense to me. You know, we're kind of now in a specific square of Manhattan. And there are basically two even more specific areas that we're going to discuss, one of which I'm just going to refer to as the Bowery, which is just south of the focus of today's episode, the East Village. You know what? If you Google any of this, you'll see exactly what we're talking about, but the entire area that I'm going to talk about today is easily walkable. It's not a huge space that we're talking about. All right, enough geography. History time. 1969. You know what? Actually, let's go back even further, because to understand CBGB, it's important to know the history of the man behind it, Hilly Kristal. Hilly, which is actually short for Hillel, was born in 1931, and he studied music in college, and he was part of a men's choral group that used to perform at Radio City Music Hall. In the late 40s and into the 50s, among other jobs, he was the manager at the Village Vanguard, big jazz club here in New York City, and he was responsible for booking some of the most bleeding edge and now iconic performers in jazz history. Miles Davis, John Coltrane, you name it, Hilly put him on stage. So really, even before his first club was even thought of, he was massively important to the New York City music scene, and in turn, the world music scene. In 1966, he was co-founder of the Rheingold Central Park Music Festival, and over the years, everyone from Bob Marley to Led Zeppelin to Ray Charles to Frank Zappa performed, though his involvement with the festival was over by the 70s, but still, the guy breathed music. 1969 saw the opening of Hilly's on the Bowery, in the Bowery, but that only lasted about 3 years, mostly due to complaints from neighbors about the noise. So this led him to focus on a space that was just up the street, located at 315 Bowery, and that would become CBGB. Now, as many people know, CBGB isn't the complete name of the club. The full name was CBGB and OMFUG, and it stands for, do you remember? Country, Bluegrass, Blues, and Other Music for Uplifting Gormandizers. Yeah, mouthful for sure. Now, the word gormandizer is usually used referring to someone ravenously eating food, and Hilly used to mean it was just for people who wanted to ingest as much music as possible, which is something we can all relate to, right? At its inception, CBGB was intended to be a country and blues bar that would also have poetry readings and things of that nature. But the neighborhood and culture would push things in other directions. Speaking of the neighborhood, let's talk about the East Village for a few minutes, as some might argue that it was more responsible for the eventual outcome than Hilly himself. Until the early 60s, the East Village was basically the Lower East Side, you know, didn't have its own special name, but it was known for a large population of Ukrainians, Russians, and Jews, which, to be honest, is why it still has some of the best damn food in the city, like Veselka. I'm not being paid to say that. I love eating there. Anyway, in the 50s, it became a hotbed for jazz musicians and beatniks, largely due to the cost of living, as well as the proximity to the more avant music clubs. But it was really in the 60s where the East Village came alive. Around 1966, Andy Warhol started to run his infamous parties in the Village, and at many of these events, a then-unknown Velvet Underground were the band playing. Venues like the Electric Circus and the Fillmore East opened a few years later, and it's sort of like what Haight-Ashbury was to San Francisco, so became the East Village to New York City, as in, that's where all the freaks went. You know what, sometime soon, we're going to get into the Fillmore East, aka the Church of Rock and Roll, as it was beyond unique, and the artists that shared the bills there, oh, it'll make your head spin. But the point here is, even before Hilly Kristal opened the doors to CBGB, the neighborhood was already a destination for musicians and overly creative types and, you know, that somewhat seedy culture that comes along with it. So, back to 315 Bowery. In December of 1973, Hilly's officially opened its doors in its new spot. Oh, wait. Did I mention that CBGB was originally named something else? Yeah. Basically, Hilly closed his first place, which we mentioned earlier, and then focused on his other spot that was just up the street, simply called Hilly's. Not to be confused with the place that just closed, Hilly's on the Bowery. It's a good thing none of this is confusing, right? Right. Now, for the record, it wasn't even Hilly that had the idea of having concerts at the club. It was two regulars, Bill Page and Rusty McKenna. After convincing Hilly he should give it a shot, he booked the band Squeeze, and no, not that Squeeze, it was a local band with the same name, who would play twice a week. This was February of 1974, and really the beginning of CBGB's transformation into a music mecca. There was another important early band at CBGB, and they were basically the house band, the Revelons. And in that band was Fred Smith, who would eventually join Television, and J.D. Doherty, who would play with Patti Smith. Now note that none of the early bands played anything resembling punk rock, but they were certainly different than any of the other rock bands of the era. You know, they were more artsy. But in my opinion, what really led to the rise of CBGB was actually the very literal collapse of the Mercer Arts Center, which was a super edgy art space also in the neighborhood. Many would say that the Mercer Arts Center is where Shakespeare slammed into Sonic Reducer. And as early as 1972, bands like the New York Dolls were holding a weekly residency. To me, this is really where the New York City rock scene is born, and where all of the avant-garde happenings and whatnot were going down. This is also where you could see performances by the band Sniper, who had a member named Jeffrey Hyman, a guy we're going to discuss soon. This is where they got their start. And you also had the likes of Patti Smith and Richard Hell, and early incarnations of so many CBGB legends got their start at the Mercer Arts Center. But on the afternoon of August 9th, 1973, the building quite literally collapsed. The entire 8-floor structure fell in, killing a handful of people inside. So this leaves us with a massive group of artists and innovators who suddenly have no place to meet, perform, collaborate, you know, the whole nine. Enter CBGB. You see, there was one other thing you need to understand, and it's still very relevant today. Most bars do not want original music. They want cover bands for their patrons to enjoy, or just a jukebox. Finding a bar that would allow bands, especially unsigned bands, to play their own songs, that was something really unique. And in fact, Hilly was said to take things further, basically banning bands from playing cover sets at CBGB. Some believe he was just trying to avoid paying royalties, but I think it was more about real performance and real musical art. Along with that, the bands had to load their own gear in and out. He is infamous for this one. And while it may seem like a no-brainer in modern times, it was a very different idea in the early 70s. There just wasn't another space in town where a band could just show up and be themselves. It provided a place to just sort of try out whatever they wanted musically, and countless bands would have their first gigs on the stage of CBGB. This is really where much of the DIY mentality comes from. Case in point, while Hilly was ready to start booking more live acts after the Mercer Arts Center collapse, he had one problem. No stage. Enter Television. The band Television. As the legend goes, in March of 1974, a recently formed Television approached Hilly to ask if they could play. He said yes, if they were willing to build a stage. And they did. March 31st, 1974. Television play their first formal show, and they would eventually play every Sunday night at CBGB. So, if you're looking for a date that marks the beginning of the 1970s punk rock movement, March 31st, 1974 certainly fits the bill. That's not to say that punk wasn't in existence before then, because you can easily trace punk back into the 1930s, but in its most commonly known form, this is really the starting point. Now, CBGB didn't become the punk rock mecca after just one show from Television, but if the stories are to be believed, at a Television show in mid-April, Patti Smith and Lenny Kaye were already in the audience. But the big changes? Yeah, they were happening on the other side of the East River. In the neighborhood of Forest Hills in Queens, John Cummings and Thomas Erdelyi formed a band called Tangerine Puppets while in high school together. Shortly after that, they became friends with a kid named Douglas Colvin, who had recently moved with his family from Germany. John and Douglas decided to start a different band, and they enlisted the help of another local kid, Jeffrey Hyman. We just talked about him earlier as being part of that band at the Mercer Arts Center. Well, Thomas would eventually replace Jeffrey on drums when Jeffrey moved to become the lead singer of this new band. And true story, the day before Television's first gig at CBGB, these four friends played their first show in front of people at the Performance Studios in Manhattan. The songs were unimaginably short, most clocking in at under 2 minutes, and writer Legs McNeil, who was at that show, said, quote, "They were all wearing these black leather jackets, and they counted off this song, and it was just this wall of noise. They just looked so striking. These guys were not hippies. This was something completely new." These guys were clearly a force to be reckoned with, but their names probably don't ring a bell to most people. Jeffrey, Thomas, John, and Douglas? Well, you might know them better as Joey, Tommy, Johnny, and Dee Dee, the Ramones. Take it, dude. Watch out, dude. On August 16th of 1974, the Ramones played their first gig at CBGB, and in many ways set the sonic blueprint for the punk rock explosion. But this is also where you can begin to see the true uniqueness of CBGB as a club, because television sound nothing like the Ramones, who sound nothing like the other bands who would make their name at the club, like Blondie, or Talking Heads, or the Heartbreakers, or the Cramps, or the B-52s, or Suicide. The list goes on and on and on. Hilly Crystal's aim to have a place where anyone could get on stage and perform as long as it was original was starting to yield some incredible results. It was just this nightly explosion of creativity, and the crowd most nights was comprised of members of other bands, all supporting one another and constantly pushing the artistic envelope forward, or in the case of a band like the Ramones, perfecting a powerfully simple sound. It was really the combination of art and free thought and rock and roll all coming together in a way that most of the music labels just didn't know what to do with, and that in itself made it one of the coolest, most important places to be at the time. But it extended beyond New York City. If you wanted to be considered a legitimate punk rock band at the time, you had to have played CBGB, whether it was the Dead Boys coming in from Cleveland and kind of making their name there, or when the Damned came to the United States for the first time. They played CBGB because that's what you had to do. It wasn't always great. Some bands went on there some nights and it just sucked. But it was okay because they were trying something new. They were going against everything else that was going on in the music scene, and that's what made that place work. It was, to use a modern phrase, a safe space where you could just go up there, throw something up against the wall, and see if it stuck. And the cool thing is that on most nights, it stuck for a long time. Now, I could go on about punk rock for hours, but this is about CBGB as a venue, and its impact goes well beyond the bands we've mentioned thus far, because like it or not, the golden era of punk was over by 1981, and artsy bands like Blondie and Talking Heads were playing in arenas, leaving a massive void inside CBGB. In the wake of the punk scene, another counterculture sound began to emerge, mostly from New York City and, slightly unexpectedly, Washington, D.C. At the end of the 70s and early 80s, as those punk rock bands were moving out, bands like Bad Brains and Minor Threat and Agnostic Front ushered in the era of hardcore, and CBGB became a focal point for the movement. In fact, hardcore became such an integral part of the venue that for a number of years, Sunday was known as Thrash Day, and the club would have hardcore and eventually metal bands playing from the afternoon into the late evening. This was eventually banned due to excessive violence around 1990, but they still brought some hardcore bands back from time to time. Oh, also, in 1982, a trio comprised of the future Luscious Jackson drummer Kate Schellenbach, along with Adam Yauch and Mike Diamond, made their debut at CBGB under the name, the Beastie Boys. Yeah, they played there too. 1982. But CBGB came to embody the New York City attitude in many ways. That is to say that their mentality was, look however you want, create art however you want, and look the hell out because there's a ton of attitude inside. The club was unafraid, if not even proud, of being different, of being freaks, and they embraced it as they saw it as the way towards musical evolution. Sadly, though, the story of CBGB has a slow, frustrating final chapter, and many people, myself included, sort of wish they'd have taken Neil Young's line of it's better to burn out than fade away a little bit more to heart. Throughout the 90s and 2000s, the club sort of started to lose its way. It was becoming more about the name CBGB than the music and art happening on the stage. That is to say, the quality control sort of went out the window. In 2005, Hilly Crystal ended up in court over nearly $100,000 in allegedly unpaid rent. The judge in the case actually tried to help get 315 Bowery declared a historical landmark, but eventually the landlord and Crystal agreed that the club would vacate the space by October of 2006. For whatever reason, Hilly decided that he was going to try and move the club to a space in, yeah, Las Vegas. But that's another story that's a little too heartbreaking to tell. The final weeks of the existence of CBGB was filled with the return of many classic acts that made the venue famous, including Television, The Bad Brains, The Dictators, and even a short set by Blondie. Dee Dee, Joey, and Johnny Ramone had passed away by that point, but many of the final acts paid tribute to them in cover songs. The final show on the CBGB stage was October 15, 2006. Patti Smith was fittingly the final performer, and she spent some time during the encore reading the names of many of the musicians who made their name at the club but had died since. So what remains of CBGB? Well, 315 Bowery still exists as an address, but it's a John Varvatos fashion store. Those who know it should be a historical landmark often flip the bird as they walk by, and the store gets hit with graffiti from time to time. Adding further insult to injury, after Hilly's death in 2007, the owners of the naming rights to CBGB sold those rights to a bar and lounge inside Newark Airport. Yeah, it's airport food now, but oh, those $20 glasses of Coca-Cola are so edgy and punk rock. To me, CBGB is one of the most fascinating venues in music history. Not only because of my passion for all things punk rock and hardcore, but because of how it sort of, you know, just happened. It wasn't a drawn-out plan. It was in the right place at the right time, and like all great things, it stuck to its artistic integrity, and through fostering a community of supportive artists, changed the music scene forever. Sure, it might not have the gloss of the Whiskey a Go-Go or the endless history of the Village Vanguard, but at the end of the day, there's no other venue that had quite the same cultural impact as CBGB. So there you go. Now you know just why CBGB is so damn important, and hopefully you learned something you didn't already know about the venue. Hit me up on Twitter at TheDailyGuru or at GetEarFuel, and let me know your favorite local venue in your town. Now before we wrap the episode, I do of course have your weekly EarFuel listening assignment. For those of you new to the podcast, each week I assign an album to listen to in full, beginning to end, without any distractions or interruptions. It stems from the fact that these days, music has been largely relegated to a background task. You're driving, you're at the gym, you're at work, whatever. And this assignment is about taking some time each week to consciously listen to music for the sake of music alone. This week, since I mentioned them once or twice, and because I've listened to the record a ton this week, your listening assignment is Talking Heads' brilliant 1980 release, Remain in Light. Now, when it comes to outright musical creativity that doesn't sacrifice ear appeal, it's almost impossible to top Talking Heads. There's so much innovation and just pioneering creation here that it's hard to comprehend it all at once. At the time, many referred to them as, quote, art school punks, and as far as I'm concerned, there's not another band in history that comes even remotely close to their sound or combined talent. Remain in Light really sets itself aside from the rest of their catalog, mostly due to the polyrhythms on nearly every track. The heavy influence of Afrobeat and underlying nods to what was then a rising hip-hop sound cannot be denied, and it's these rhythmic complexities that really anchor the record. The rhythms are constantly changing from song to song, and the way Tina's bass work weaves around them, oh man, it just doesn't get much better than that. It's the way that the stiff, angular rhythms smash into the bouncing guitar and bass lines that make the song so fascinating. But it's also how they can make the sound seem so full of sound, yet allow them to have plenty of space to breathe that's, well, I suppose it's kind of the magic of Talking Heads. From the almost angry, nervous sounds of Cross-Eyed and Painless, to the droning of the Overload, to the addictive bounce of Houses in Motion, it's excellence at every turn, and let's not forget that the classic song, Once in a Lifetime, also lives on this record. The guitar riffs and progressions are nearly as diverse as the rhythms, allowing everything from angry growls to wild joy to come through the strings. And then, of course, you have the voice and words of David Byrne. The first half of this record always feels to me like a stream of consciousness in terms of the lyrics, allowing the words to become an instrument unto themselves. But you also get the rapping style delivery on part of Cross-Eyed and Painless, And it's often the movements where he lets his voice soar that become the most engaging and satisfying. If all you know of Talking Heads is their big hits, then the reality is you don't know the band for what they truly are. Their music is amazingly complex and yet not at all pretentious. It's music that begs to be explored deeper and deeper as it envelops you in walls of sound on every track. There's not a moment anywhere on Remain in Light that's less than stellar, and if you consider the just create whatever you want style that they were given at CBGB, it makes a bit more sense on how they came into this sonic brilliance. Remain in Light is one of my all-time favorite albums, so go put your ears on it right now. Thank me later. So that's all for this week. I hope you dug our brief journey into the history of CBGB. As always, the podcast is available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Earfuel, along with at getearfuel.com. That is your weekly Earfuel. Share and enjoy.